Chapter 5. I would have traveled a much greater distance than I have come to witness the paying of honors to Dr. Holmes, for my feeling toward him has always been one of peculiar warmth. When one receives a letter from a great man for the first time in his life, it is a large event to him, as all of you know by your own experience. You never can receive letters enough from famous men afterward to obliterate that one, or dim the memory of the pleasant surprise it was, and the gratification it gave you. Lapse of time cannot make it commonplace or cheap. Well, the first great man who ever wrote me a letter was our guest Oliver Wendell Holmes. He was also the first great literary man I ever stole anything from, and that is how I came to write to him, and he to me. When my first book was new, a friend of mine said to me, "The dedication is very neat." "Yes," I said, "I thought it was." My friend said, "I always admired it, even before I saw it in The Innocents Abroad." I naturally said, "Colin, what do you mean? Where did you ever see it before?" "Well, I saw it first some years ago as Dr. Holmes' dedication to his songs in many keys." Of course, my first impulse was to prepare this man's remains for burial, but upon reflection I said I would reprieve him for a moment or two, and give him a chance to prove his assertion if he could. We stepped into a bookstore, and he did prove it. I had really stolen that dedication, almost word for word. I could not imagine how this curious thing had happened. For I knew one thing, that a certain amount of pride always goes along with a teaspoonful of brains, and that this pride protects a man from deliberately stealing other people's ideas. That is what a teaspoonful of brains will do for a man, and admirers had often told me I had nearly a basketful, though they were rather reserved, as to the size of the basket. However, I thought the thing out, and solved the mystery. 2 years before, I had been laid up a couple of weeks in the Sandwich Islands, and had read, and reread Dr. Holmes' poems till my mental reservoir was filled up with them to the brim. The dedication lay on the top, and handy, so, by and by, I unconsciously stole it. Perhaps I unconsciously stole the rest of the volume too, for many people have told me that my book was pretty poetical, in one way or another. Well, of course, I wrote Dr. Holmes, and told him I hadn't meant to steal, and he wrote back and said in the kindest way, that it was all right, and no harm done, and added that he believed we all unconsciously worked over ideas gathered in reading and hearing, imagining they were original with ourselves. He stated a truth, and did it in such a pleasant way, and salved over my sore spot so gently and so healingly, that I was rather glad I had committed the crime, for the sake of the letter. I afterward called on him, and told him to make perfectly free with any ideas of mine, that struck him as being good protoplasm for poetry. He could see by that there wasn't anything mean about me, so we got along right from the start. I have not met Dr. Holmes many times since, and lately he said, however, I am wandering wildly away from the one thing which I got on my feet to do, that is, to make my compliments to you, my fellow teachers of the great public, and likewise to say that I am right glad to see that Dr. Holmes is still in his prime and full of generous life, and as age is not determined by years, but by trouble and infirmities of mind and body, I hope it may be a very long time yet before anyone can truthfully say, he is growing old." The Weather Address at the New England Society's 71st Annual Dinner, New York City. The next toast was Colin, the oldest inhabitant, the weather of New England. Who can lose it, and forget it? Who can have it and regret it? The interposer twixt us twain. Merchant of Venice. I reverently believe that the maker who made us all makes everything in New England but the weather. I don't know who makes that, but I think it must be raw apprentices in the weather clerk's factory who experiment and learn how, in New England, for board and clothes, and then are promoted to make weather for countries that require a good article, and will take their custom elsewhere if they don't get it. There is a sumptuous variety about the New England weather that compels the stranger's admiration and regret. The weather is always doing something there, always attending strictly to business, always getting up new designs and trying them on the people, to see how they will go. But it gets through more business in spring than in any other season. In the spring I have counted 136 different kinds of weather inside of 24 hours. It was I that made the fame and fortune of that man, that had that marvelous collection of weather on exhibition at the Centennial, that so astounded the foreigners. He was going to travel all over the world, and get specimens from all the climes. I said, "Don't you do it. You come to New England on a favorable spring day." I told him what we could do in the way of style, variety, and quantity. Well, he came and he made his collection in 4 days. As to variety, why, he confessed that he got hundreds of kinds of weather that he had never heard of before. And as to quantity, well, after he had picked out and discarded all that was blemished in any way, he not only had weather enough, but weather to spare, weather to hire out, weather to sell, to deposit, weather to invest, weather to give to the poor. The people of New England are by nature patient and forbearing, but there are some things which they will not stand. Every year they kill a lot of poets for writing about odorful spring. These are generally casual visitors, who bring their notions of spring from somewhere else, and cannot, of course, know how the natives feel about spring. And so the first thing they know the opportunity to inquire how they feel has permanently gone by. Old Probabilities has a mighty reputation for accurate prophecy, and thoroughly well deserves it. You take up the paper, and observe how crisply and confidently he checks off what today's weather is going to be on the Pacific, down south, in the Middle States, in the Wisconsin region. See him sail along in the joy and pride of his power till he gets to New England, and then see his tail drop. He doesn't know what the weather is going to be in New England. Well, he mulls over it, and by he gets out something about like this. Probably northeast to southwest winds, varying to the southward, and westward and eastward, and points between, high and low barometer swapping around from place to place, probable areas of rain, snow, hail, and drought, succeeded or preceded by earthquakes, with thunder and lightning. Then he jots down his postscript from his wandering mind, to cover accidents. But it is possible that the program may be wholly changed in the meantime. Yes, one of the brightest gems in the New England weather is the dazzling uncertainty of it. There is only one thing certain about it. You are certain there is going to be plenty of it, a perfect grand review, but you never can tell which end of the procession is going to move first. You fix up for the drought. You leave your umbrella in the house and sally out, and 2-1 you get drowned. You make up your mind that the earthquake is due. You stand from under and take hold of something to steady yourself, and the first thing you know you get struck by lightning. These are great disappointments, but they can't be helped. The lightning there is peculiar. It is so convincing that when it strikes a thing it doesn't leave enough of that thing behind for you to tell whether, well, you'd think it was something valuable, and a congressman had been there. And the thunder. When the thunder begins to merely tune up and scrape and saw, and key up the instruments for the performance, strangers say, "Why, what awful thunder you have here." But when the baton is raised, and the real concert begins, you'll find that stranger down in the cellar with his head in the ash barrel. Now as to the size of the weather in New England lengthways, I mean. It is utterly disproportioned to the size of that little country. Half the time, when it is packed as full as it can stick, you will see that New England weather sticking out beyond the edges and projecting around hundreds and hundreds of miles over the neighboring states. She can't hold a tenth part of her weather. You can see cracks all about where she has strained herself trying to do it. I could speak volumes about the inhuman perversity of the New England weather, but I will give but a single specimen. I like to hear rain on the tin roof. So I covered part of my roof with tin, with an eye to that luxury. Well, sir, do you think it ever rains on that tin?
No, sir. Skips it every time.
Mind, in this speech I have been trying, merely to do honor to the New England weather, no language could do it justice. But, after all, there is at least one or two things about that weather, or, if you please, effects produced by it, which we residents would not like to part with. If we hadn't our bewitching autumn foliage, we should still have to credit the weather with one feature which compensates for all its bullying vagaries, the ice storm. When a leafless tree is clothed with ice from the bottom to the top, ice that is as bright and clear as crystal, when every bough and twig is strung with ice beads, frozen dew drops, and the whole tree sparkles cold and white, like the Shah of Persia's diamond plume. Then the wind waves the branches, and the sun comes out and turns all those myriads of beads and drops to prisms, that glow and burn and flash with all manner of colored fires, which change and change again with inconceivable rapidity from blue to red, from red to green, and green to gold. The tree becomes a spraying fountain, a very explosion of dazzling jewels. And it stands there, the acme, the climax, the supremest possibility in art or nature, of bewildering, intoxicating, intolerable magnificence. One cannot make the words too strong. The babies, delivered at the banquet, in Chicago, given by the Army of the Tennessee to their first commander, General U.S. Grant, November, 1879, the 15th regular toast was, "Ye babies. As they comfort us in our sorrows, let us not forget them in our festivities." I like that. We have not all had the good fortune to be ladies. We have not all been generals, or poets, or statesmen. But when the toast works down to the babies, we stand on common ground. It is a shame that for 1,000 years the world's banquets have utterly ignored the baby, as if he didn't amount to anything. If you will stop and think a minute, if you will go back 50 or 100 years to your early married life, and recontemplate your first baby, you will remember that he amounted to a good deal, and even something over. You soldiers all know that, when that little fellow arrived at family headquarters, you had to hand in your resignation. He took entire command. You became his lackey, his mere body servant, and you had to stand around too. He was not a commander who made allowances for time, distance, weather, or anything else. You had to execute his order, whether it was possible or not. And there was only one form of marching in his manual of tactics, and that was the double quick. He treated you with every sort of insolence and disrespect, and the bravest of you didn't dare to say a word. You could face the death storm at Donelson and Vicksburg, and give back blow for blow, but when he clawed your whiskers, and pulled your hair, and twisted your nose, you had to take it. When the thunders of war were sounding in your ears, you set your faces toward the batteries, and advanced with steady tread. But when he turned on the terrors of his war whoop, you advanced in the other direction, and mighty glad of the chance to. When he called for soothing syrup, did you venture to throw out any side-dash remarks about certain services, being unbecoming an officer and a gentleman? No. You got up and got it. When he ordered his pap bottle, and it was not warm, did you talk back? Not you. You went to work and warmed it. You even descended, so far in your menial office, as to take a suck at that warm, insipid stuff yourself, to see if it was right, 3 parts water to 1 of milk, a touch of sugar to modify the colic, and a drop of peppermint to kill those immortal hiccups. I can taste that stuff yet. And how many things you learned as you went along. Sentimental young folks still take stock in that beautiful old saying, that when the baby smiles in his sleep, it is because the angels are whispering to him. Very pretty, but too thin, simply wind on the stomach, my friends. If the baby proposed to take a walk at his usual hour, 2 o'clock in the morning, didn't you rise up promptly and remark, with a mental addition which would not improve a Sunday school book much, that that was the very thing you were about to propose yourself? Oh,
You were under good discipline, and as you went fluttering up and down the room in your undress uniform, you not only prattled undignified baby talk, but even tuned up your martial voices and tried to sing Rock-a-bye Baby in the Treetop, for instance. What a spectacle for an Army of the Tennessee! And what an affliction for the neighbors too! For it is not everybody within a mile around that likes military music at 3 a.m. And, when you had been keeping this sort of thing up 2 or 3 hours, and your little velvet head intimated that nothing suited him like exercise and noise, what did you do? You simply went on until you dropped in the last ditch. The idea that a baby doesn't amount to anything. Why, one baby is just a house, and a front yard full by itself. One baby can furnish more business than you and your whole interior department can attend to. He is enterprising, irrepressible, brimful of lawless activities. Do what you please, you can't make him stay on the reservation. Sufficient unto the day is one baby. As long as you are in your right mind, don't you ever pray for twins. Twins amount to a permanent riot. And there ain't any real difference between triplets and an insurrection. Yes, it was high time for a toastmaster to recognize the importance of the babies. Think what is in store for the present crop. 50 years from now we shall all be dead, I trust, and then this flag, if it still survive, and let us hope it may, will be floating over a republic numbering 200,000,000 souls, according to the settled laws of our increase. Our present schooner of state will have grown into a political leviathan, a Great Eastern. The cradled babies of today will be on deck. Let them be well trained, for we are going to leave a big contract on their hands. Among the 3 or 4 million cradles now rocking in the land are some which this nation would preserve for ages as sacred things, if we could know which ones they are. In one of these cradles the unconscious Farragut of the future is at this moment teething, think of it, and putting in a world of dead earnest, unarticulated, but perfectly justifiable profanity over it too. In another the future renowned astronomer is blinking at the shining Milky Way with, but a languid interest, poor little chap, and wondering what has become of that other one they call the wet nurse. In another the future great historian is lying and doubtless will continue to lie until his earthly mission is ended. In another the future president is busying himself with no profounder problem of state than what the mischief has become of his hair so early. And in a mighty array of other cradles there are now some 60,000 future office seekers, getting ready to furnish him occasion to grapple with that same old problem a second time. And in still one more cradle, somewhere under the flag, the future illustrious commander in dash chief of the American armies is so little burdened with his approaching grandeurs and responsibilities, as to be giving his whole strategic mind at this moment to trying to find out some way to get his big toe into his mouth, an achievement which, meaning no disrespect, the illustrious guest of this evening turned his entire attention to some 56 years ago. And if the child is but a prophecy of the man, there are mighty few who will doubt that he succeeded. Our Children and Great Discoveries, delivered at the Authors Club New York, are children, yours and mine. They seem like little things to talk about our children, but little things often make up the sum of human life. That's a good sentence. I repeat it, little things often produce great things. Now, to illustrate, take Sir Isaac Newton. I presume some of you have heard of Mr. Newton. Well, once when Sir Isaac Newton, a mere lad, got over into the man's apple orchard, I don't know what he was doing there. I didn't come all the way from Hartford to question Mr. Newton's honesty, but when he was there in the main orchard, he saw an apple fall, and he was attracted toward it, and that led to the discovery not of Mr. Newton, but of the great law of attraction and gravitation. And there was once another great discoverer, I've forgotten his name, and I don't remember what he discovered, but I know it was something very important, and I hope you will all tell your children about it when you get home. Well, when the great discoverer was once loafing around down in Virginia, and a-puttin' in his time flirting with Pocahontas, oh, Captain John Smith, that was the man's name, and while he and Poca were sitting in Mr. Poetin's garden, he accidentally put his arm around her, and picked something simple weed, which proved to be tobacco, and now we find it in every Christian family, shedding its civilizing influence broadcast throughout the whole religious community. Now there was another great man, I can't think of his name either, who... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.